From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Barbara Slavin, Acting Director of the Future of Iran Initiative at the Atlantic Council and Washington correspondent for El Monitor. Joining me on the show this week are Tom DeFrank, contributing editor at National Journal, and Oren Durrell, foreign affairs reporter for USA Today. And here are the issues. The outgoing director of National Intelligence and other senior U.S. officials confirm their finding that Russia interfered with U.S. presidential elections by hacking Democratic Party emails and spreading fake news stories. The new U.S. Congress took office and immediately stumbled into controversy. There were efforts in the House to reduce the power of a body that investigates ethical lapses by members of Congress, and the Senate started work on legislation enabling the quick repeal of President Obama's signature health care program without having anything immediately to replace it. Overseas, Turkey fell victim to yet more political violence. Turkish officials directed their anger at the United States, which it blames for harboring a fugitive spiritual leader and for new militancy by Turkish Kurds. Gentlemen, let's start with the issue of Russian hacking. Oren, there was a hearing on Capitol Hill. The director of National Intelligence, the head of the National Security Agency, a senior Pentagon official, all spoke about their findings, and their conclusion was Russia hacked, yes?
Yes. They described a whole pattern of Russian hacking. Basically, they said that the effort was aimed at helping Donald Trump, or at least hurting his adversary, Hillary Clinton, who was running for president. What was kind of remarkable about this hearing was that despite the aspersions that Donald Trump has made regarding this whole issue of the Russian hack and whether it played a role in the election, there was really a united front among lawmakers against Russia and supporting this idea that they were involved in the hacking and supporting the intelligence community, which is in danger of, damaged morale and is being basically in conflict now with Donald Trump, who doesn't seem to accept their conclusions.
Yeah. Well, Tom, the heads of the intelligence agencies are all briefing Donald Trump, flying to New York. I mean, the head of the CIA, the director of national intelligence, the head of the NSA, rather extraordinary that this is necessary. But when you look at some of the things that, Trump has tweeted, his support for Julian Assange, who is, of course, the head of WikiLeaks and is a fugitive from justice holed up in the Ecuadorian embassy in London, and he is being defended by Donald Trump and by Donald Trump's surrogates. What can we make of that?
Well, I think what that's all about, Barbara, is that President-elect Trump seems to think that everything that's coming out is somehow going to delegitimize his election. If people believe that he only won because the Russians helped destroy Hillary through these very targeted leaks, then somehow people will decide, well, maybe his election is not legitimate. I mean, I think it's an ego thing with Trump, and it's in certain respects. I mean, whatever else you think about Trump, whether you love him or loathe him, and there are millions on both sides of that issue, he was duly elected. He will be sworn in less than 2 weeks as president of the United States. And so I think, frankly, one of the ironies here is part of this new report suggests that the Russians thought that they were going to fail. They thought that even with all their meddling and their interference and their trying to put their thumb on the electoral scale, that Hillary Clinton would win regardless. And they seem to be delighted that she didn't. So it's hard to know what other factors Trump could be dealing with here, because these are the people who are dedicated to keeping America free and giving him the best intelligence he can get.
America safe from terrorist attacks.
So right. And so for him to constantly disparage them just seems to be not a smart strategy, and the Assange thing is also very strange, because not that many months ago or a couple of years ago, candidate Trump called Assange essentially a treasonous behavior.
Yeah.
So there's multiple issues here, and like you say, there's this prelude to this meeting with intelligence chiefs who are going to brief him. You know, at this point, Trump is sort of on the fence about whether he's going to accept their conclusions.
The unanimous conclusions of 17
right, but
intelligence
if he, agencies. If he does, you know, there are questions about whether it throws the intelligence community into a credibility issue, whether it questions the credibility of the intelligence community. I wonder whether whether it questions the credibility of Donald Trump. But either way, he becomes president on the 20th, and there's apparently, according to the Wall Street Journal reported, that there's a plan that Trump camp denies to restructure or cut back staffing at the CIA and the Office of the Director of National Intelligence. By itself, that's not a bad idea, because the idea would be to put more case officers out in the field, which is always a good thing, right?
Right. Well, but you do need people to analyze their work.
You need analysts.
And direct them.
You need analysts. But the idea is that there's a deficit of on-the-ground intelligence. But in this context, all this doubt that has been created about the intelligence community sort of play into such a plan.
Yeah, I think one of the things that's most concerning, and this came up in the hearing, Tom, was the whole question of morale in the intelligence agencies. And if you want to recruit people and retain good people, and I'm thinking in particular of the cyber area, where experts in cybersecurity have plenty of places they can go that are much more lucrative than the federal government. They can work for cybersecurity firms and so on, for private companies that will pay them a great deal of money. And there was an interesting moment during the hearing. I think it was Claire McCaskill, Democratic senator, who asked James Clapper. Let's see if I can find the quotation here. But yeah, it was.
Do you have the quotation about
what, you know, what will it do if you have this kind of this treatment? Do you have the quotation there? Exact one.
Clapper said that there's an important distinction between healthy skepticism
and despair,
which policymakers, to include policymaker number one,
right,
meaning President-elect Trump, should always have for intelligence, but I think there is a difference between skepticism
and disparagement.
Yeah,
I was trying to think of the question that preceded it, but it was basically a question about, you know, what does it tell us that the president-elect keeps, you know, dissing our intelligence services, and what is that going to do to them?
Well, it raises the question of whether there's something more to this complicated relationship between Putin and Trump. And of course, it raises all sorts of conspiracy theories about what does Trump have to hide, or what Putin have on Trump, all of which is just sheer speculation. But those sorts of suggestions, even if they're totally spurious, come against a backdrop where more and more Americans, and certainly many, many senior Republicans in Congress, like Senator John McCain, who chaired a hearing, believe that the Russians are bad guys. Even the Senate Majority Leader, Mitch McConnell, said Russia is not our friend. Something is going on here, and it's going to be interesting to see how Trump reacts to these briefings. FBI Director James Comey is also on the list of individuals briefing Trump, and it'll be really interesting to see what he says after they've said to him what it is they're going to say to him.
In fairness, he did tweet later on, this was that the dishonest media likes saying that I am in agreement with Julian Assange. Wrong. I simply state what he states. It is for the people to make up their own minds as to the truth. The media lies to make it look like I am against intelligence, in quotes, when, in fact, I am a big fan. So I think he's trying to have it always here, Aaron. Yes?
When I look at this story, the most important aspect of it is the content of what they're actually talking about. And the fact that this campaign, I guess, that's alleged against Russia, you know, that they've hacked the DNC emails, the Democratic National Committee, that they provided information to WikiLeaks and released it for political gains. You know, this is a story that I'm working on for USA Today, that this fits a pattern of Russian behavior that we've seen in Europe over a decade. It involves, you know, like Clapper said, you know, that hacking is one element of an operation that included, quote, classic propaganda, disinformation, and fake news.
Right.
And this is something that the Russians have done in Ukraine, in Bulgaria, in Poland, in Moldova, in France, in Germany. They've used hacking and other types of political meddling to sow discord and create doubt among voters in Western institutions. And the fact that we're having this conversation, the fact that the Congress is divided among itself exactly about how to deal with this, and is divided between itself and the president about you know, attribution. These all fit a pattern of behavior that we've seen implemented by Russia, and it's part of a overall warfare strategy that the Russians have that uses a multi-spectral, multi-level types of attack. In addition, you know, apart from kinetic warfare. Yeah. To against their adversaries.
Look, cyber is a new element in this, but, you know, in the Soviet era, it was called disinformatsia, and it was widely used to discredit those who opposed the Soviet Union. And, of course, the United States, back in the day, the CIA had its own fake newspapers, fake magazines, and it planted false information. The Mossad, the Israeli intelligence service, is not above doing the same. They have a habit of planting false information in British newspapers. Certainly they used to in the past. I imagine they still are. So, you know, nobody's hands are entirely clean. But I think you're right that this has become, for Putin, who is himself, of course, ex-KGB, a prime means of dealing with Russia's conventional weakness, its economic weakness, by using these tools and using them very effectively.
You know, Barbara, I was in Texas a few days ago, and I was talking with a guy on economic policy, and he said there's a triangle in Texas that begins in Dallas and goes to Houston and over to San Antonio. And he said within that circle, the gross domestic product is far more than the entire GDP of Russia, trying to make the point that while you have to recognize that Russia is a powerful potential adversary because of nuclear weapons, they are not an economic powerhouse, so they'll never be an economic powerhouse. And I agree with Oren, all of what we see here, setting aside the U.S. election for a moment, what we see here is a longstanding effort by the Russians, and especially Putin, to destabilize and undermine Western democracies and puff up
his own regime. Yes.
Exactly right, which if he didn't have nukes, and if he didn't have oil, would be even more of a basket case economically than it is today.
All right. We'll have more in just a minute. First, a reminder that you're listening to Issues in the News coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. I'm your moderator, Barbara Slavin of AllMonitor, and joining me today are Oren Durrell of USA Today and Tom DeFrank of National Journal. And this is a reminder that you can listen to Issues online as a podcast. The program is also available for free download on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. One other point about this, and Oren, you're right, there was a bipartisan acceptance of the fact that Russia was responsible at the hearing. But Senator Tom Cotton, one a Republican senator, tried to make the point that Trump was advocating policies that would hurt Russia. He wanted more oil exploration, which would lower the price of oil. He wanted to modernize American nuclear forces and even expand them, which would somehow undercut Russian power. So I thought that was an interesting argument. He was trying to somehow prove that Trump was not entirely pro-Putin. But there's a lot of concern that Trump is going to move to relieve sanctions on Russia over Ukraine and take other steps that would favor Russian interests.
You're right that Senator Cotton was trying to show that maybe the Russians wouldn't have wanted Trump to win the presidency because he's in favor of a strong defense. But Trump has said many things that are friendly to Russia. He's talked about working together with Russia in Syria against ISIL, which is a whole other conversation that I don't really understand. But, you know, he's talked about cooperating with Russia, and you know, he's asked in previous tweets long, you know, years ago, he's asked whether Putin will be his best friend. But I guess a lot of what we're seeing, to me, looks like something that, like things that Vladimir Putin would have wanted. And, you know, we're hearing evidence from the intelligence community, if you believe it, that the Russians were celebrating Donald Trump's victory at the election.
Yeah, well, the most fantastical theory I saw, Tom, was that Trump is actually sort of softening Putin up, and that, you know, by throwing all these sweet words at him, and that he actually will be very tough on Russia once in office. But we will see. We will see. Meanwhile, I want to move on to other happenings on Capitol Hill. The new Congress has come in. And their first act, at least in the House of Representatives, was a rather strange one. Can you explain?
Much like they shot themselves in both feet and both arms. Barbara, the Trump administration will be the 10th that I will have covered as a White House correspondent. And so I have whatever else I have, I have a little bit of historical context and institutional memory, and there is a pattern with new presidents. No matter how profound or how modest their margin of victory is, there tends to be this hubris
right.
coming in the door, which basically says, we know what we're doing, we don't need your help, and we are so powerful that we can do what we want to do. I mean, I can remember a Carter administration incoming official. After Watergate, after Carter beat Ford, who replaced a disgraced President Nixon, this guy said to me, we just put an end to 8 stinking years of corrupt Republican rule. We know what we're doing. We don't need your help.
Oh, Lord.
Well, and I think now Republicans are showing some evidence of that same hubris. One of the first things they do is try to scuttle something called the Office of Government Ethics, which is a congressionally mandated ethics watchdog. What the Republicans wanted to do was basically turn it into a talking point society or a debating society and make them subject to the House Ethics Committee, which under the Republicans has been one of the more toothless entities on policing congressional ethics ever. And I find it ironic, this proposal to do this and to gut the Office of Government Ethics, OGE, was done in the middle of the night, slipped into a resolution without debate, without notice, and it seems to have gone down the drain when Donald Trump, when President-elect Trump, put out a tweet saying, why don't we worry, in effect, why don't we worry about things that are really important
well,
first?
Well, it wasn't just Donald Trump. There were calls. The switchboard was completely jammed with calls
from
outraged constituents, right?
I think that's right. And I think I see the hand of Vice President-elect Mike Pence in this. Pence, a very conservative guy, I think is what I would call the voice of moderate, sane conservatism near the Trump Oval Office. And I think Mike Pence, who is very close to House Speaker Paul Ryan, who didn't like this either, I think they basically helped kill it. But it's not the sort of thing you want an incoming government to, to look like that's the most important thing that they're doing. There's this other thing that's going to be very unpopular, especially in the Washington suburbs, which have millions of federal workers, that the Republicans are trying to reinstate a very arcane procedure which would allow individual lawmakers to slash the pay of an individual federal employee by down to $1 as an inducement to force them out of office. I think that will probably die as well. But I go back to this point about hubris. This is not the way smart people should be starting a new administration. It makes the president-elect look bad. It makes the Republican leadership in the House look bad. And it just suggests we're going to see more of what we saw over the last 4 years, which is Republican leadership in the House of Representatives struggling forever to try to get the zealots, to put it charitably, the far right of the far right in Congress to behave.
Yep.
That's going to be difficult.
Yeah.
So a lot about this. First of all, this Office of Congressional Ethics was created after the Jack Abramoff scandal, which put 3 or 4 members of Congress in prison for corruption, for accepting bribes, basically. You know, and the members voted to change it and then reversed themselves the next day. All this was covered very broadly in the news, but there were a lot of things that kind of slipped by that weren't very well covered, and one of them is the rule that allows them to fire any or reduce the pay of any federal employee to $1. What it is, it's a rule that allows any member to make a proposal to reduce any individual employee's pay to $1 or to cancel any federal program.
This is chaos.
It gives individual members a lot of power. And then it has to be put to a vote. It can be voted by a simple majority. There's also a rule fining members for breaking debate rules, such as what the Democrats, a sit-in that the Democrats did for gun control in the last session.
Right.
There's a rule that limits votes on legislation to increase the budget deficit by $5 billion or more, which is aimed at the at Obamacare. There's a rule dealing with committee oversight that could move these programs, these entitlement programs, to the discretionary side of the Federal Register, which would make it remove their automatic funding from year to year.
None of this
is being covered.
This is scary stuff.
It's scary. It's serious stuff. It's stuff that's very powerful. It's procedural stuff, and it's aimed at enacting this very dramatic program that the Republicans, this unified government of you know, Republicans controlling the House and the Senate and the White House, mm-hmm. and eventually the mm-hmm. Supreme Court, to basically diminish the entitlement programs, get rid of Obamacare. But, you know, but as this is moving forward, and this is apparently moving forward very quickly now, this whole issue of repealing Obamacare, it's I mean, they've already taken these early steps to weaken it and to repeal it, but they don't seem to have a replacement in hand. They were asked about it multiple times.
This is incredible after all they complained for over the last six, 7 years.
Speaker Ryan said that they're looking for a transition that doesn't pull the rug out from anyone. That's a quote. But they won't provide any details about how that's going to be done. I forget how many thousands of pages the ACA, the...
It's the size of a large phone book,
The Obamacare was, but one of the replacements that Republicans have right now is something like 180 pages. So it's a much more slimmed down version. There's 20 million people who gained health insurance because of Obamacare. And, you know, there's people like Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia, former governor there. He's a Democrat, but his state voted for Donald Trump, and he's willing to talk to the Republicans. But he says, you know, that his voters might not know, you know, how they got it, but they'll know how they lost it, referring to this health care program.
Tom, the Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer said that the motto should be "Make America Sick Again."
Right. But he also Senator Schumer has reprised Colin Powell's famous argument in the run-up to the second Iraq war, when he was arguing with President George W. Bush, if we invade Iraq and we take it over, we own it.
Yeah, if you break it.
Right. And Schumer is now saying, if the Republicans repeal health care, Obamacare, they own it. Mm-hmm. We're not going to step in and say, oh, well, let's do this, let's do this, let's do that, let's bail them out. And so far, the Republicans have not come up with a workable alternative. And Orrin is exactly right. If there was a very poignant story I read a week or so ago about some super-duper Trump supporter whose husband had a kidney transplant and has a $500,000 medical bill. And she's now worried, they're both now worried that under these Republican plans, he may not be able to pay those bills going forward because he's going to be a sick guy for a while. And so I think there's going to be a backlash here on the Republicans.
I want to quickly mention Turkey because we are running out of time. We've spent our time talking about domestic issues. But Orrin, there was a terrible incident at a nightclub on New Year's Eve. 39 people killed, mostly tourists from Arab countries coming to Turkey. More violence a few days later at a police station in Izmir. Something like 700 people have died in terrorist incidents in Turkey in the last 18 months. And the Turkish government is blaming the United States. how worried should we be about stability in this NATO ally?
Well, Turkey's in a very precarious situation. There was also another terrorist attack just Thursday where four people were killed. Two of mm-hmm. them were militants outside a courthouse in western Turkey. One of the issues is that with this coup, with the coup attempt in July, so many members of the security forces were arrested and dismissed that the security officials are having a very difficult time rounding up suspects and breaking up these plots. They've also taken on the Kurdish politicians and political movement that is kind of aiming at independence or some kind of sovereignty, but they've had a detente over the years, and that situation is now deteriorating, and I think we can probably expect more violence in Turkey.
I'm afraid that's all the time we have. Joining us today were Tom DeFrank, contributing editor at National Journal, and Orrin Durrell, foreign affairs reporter for USA Today. This program was produced by Anya Zalewski. Our engineers were Justin Thwaites and Linus Rimkus. I'm Barbara Slavin, acting director of the Future of Iran Initiative at the Atlantic Council and Washington correspondent for El Monitor. Thanks for listening.